Good evening, ladies and gentlefers. Welcome to the South Africa Podcast. You're listening to myself, Ivic Wolf, and I'm here with my co-host, Scratch.
Incompetent as always.
Huh? Incompetent? Did you just... Oh?
It's working now, I promise.
Yay! Cool. And
Sorry, bit of a false start there.
Great. See, this is exactly what happened. Hello, everyone, and our guest today is Slate. He is the artist and story... What would you call yourself, actually?
Jesus, that's an excellent question. My title within ThinkTeak is creative director, or Think Tank. But it's just kind of a collaborator, I guess? Like story helper,
storyboard,
sounding
listener.
Board. You mentioned,
yeah, sounding board. That works. Mm.
Yeah, I mean beyond that, obviously, like a very well accomplished artist.
Oh, thank you.
I've seen your work. I'm not necessarily sure.
But it's working with Tempo is great because we feed off each other's creativity. Like he will write things that I want to draw, and I will draw things he wants to write stuff to.
Mm-hmm.
That's super handy.
And yeah, I mean, like, is it for anybody who might want to be, say, a particular writer's artist? I'm going to say artistic muse. We'll call it like that.
Sure.
Like, how does that sort of like work out? Like, is it now weirdly enough just on business basis? For instance, we could look at the entire idea. Like, is there profit sharing and things like that, or exactly how does that work?
It's very much a per case basis. Mm-hmm. It tends to be a flat fee. When it comes down to it, my role on the novels is technically illustrator.
Yeah.
And so I just take money for that and call it a day.
Oh.
Like, I'm not going to bother him for royalties or anything. But and on other projects, it works a little differently. But in terms of like artists, or if you're an artist and you have a writer and you just want to be their official artist, you could do what I did and just kind of pester them. Like,
gee, that sounds familiar.
What happened was,
whoops.
I had been tagged to make a comic for the first Dragon's Horde Nom Noms book, which is a vor themed anthology. And I knew that if I was going to make a comic, I wanted a simpler style.
Yeah.
And so I was doing a bunch of practice stuff, and one of the styles that I was kind of chasing with that was the concept art for Bolt.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, if I'm doing concept art, if I'm taking this style, I'm going to need something to draw. And if I'm drawing porn anyway, might as well draw porn of Tempo's Bolt stories. And if I've drawn Born of Tempo's Bolt stories, I might as well show them to him. And then he wanted more. And then I discovered I had the magic power to make him write stuff by drawing stuff.
Okay. So it's very
like
symbiotic.
It's like the opposite of fan art.
Yeah. Fan writing after looking at fan art.
Fan literature.
It's recursive fan fiction. Yeah. It's happened recursive a couple times.
And I mean, like, Intempo has like a whole bunch of those stories out there. I've read a couple. He randomly throws them at me too.
just to make sure the quality is up to snuff, I suppose.
Yeah, no, he.
You know, like, I mean, I'd be the last person to ask.
Now, Intempo's a big proponent of getting a lot of hands on a project in order to kind of like make sure nobody's missed anything. Because when you get the same few people over and over again, you tend to find like holes kind of develop in your methodology.
Mm-hmm.
Like there are things that as a group you just kind of overlook after a while, and it's good to get fresh opinions on that.
No, that is definitely true. Like if too many people stare at the same thing long enough, they're gonna end up missing crucial details.
Right. And so sometimes, even if it's just a matter of like, you know, getting the little kid in who will say that the emperor has no clothes, kind of a deal.
Hmm. That makes perfect sense. So many projects have tanked because of similar things.
Mm-hmm. It also, Tempo's like, you know, he is the switchboard operator of the furry fandom at this point. He's just kind of connecting everybody at this
You're not wrong there, actually.
Yeah, I was about to say that's a very apropos description. Yeah.
The amount of guests that we've come into contact with, particularly because of Tempo, they're staggeringly large amounts. And like, yeah, it's definitely somebody to thank for that, because, like, do you remember that he's also the same kind of person who went up to the people, the creators of a particular game? I can't remember what the game was anymore. It was a dragon game.
Dinotopia?
Dinosaur. Dinotopia.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I don't know what happened to that project.
It's the... I'm also involved in an art capacity on that. It's just kind of stalled because the studio that is doing it has been working on other things.
Okay.
Like, we still absolutely have hopes that it will be a thing at one point. Mm-hmm. And for those of you listening who don't know, if you're a fan, Dinotopia is a series of, I guess, illustrated folios with a loose storyline connecting them. And it's all about this island of sentient dinosaurs and the people who live among them, and it's like whimsical and optimistic, and it's just great. My inner 8-year old freaking loves Dinotopia. The problem is it has not fared well in adaptation. It's got a thoroughly mediocre miniseries and a really bad TV show and a really, really bad animated movie and a GameCube game. Yeah, Dinotopia is all about, like, you know, compassion and pacifism, and then they made a brawler out of it.
Way to stay true to the source material.
Right, but, like, they also made an adventure game, like a 90s-style isometric point-and-click adventure game.
Which was pretty good from what I saw.
It felt like Dinotopia. It looked like Dinotopia. The production values were really great for the time. Like, there are, like, FMVs with actors and puppets, and it's all very elaborate. And the problem was, as they were finishing this game, the company that made it went bankrupt.
Aww.
And got, like, swallowed up by this other company and completely buried. And so it never really got the chance it deserved.
Was it EA?
I don't remember. Oh, I think this was, like, Turner Entertainment. This was back in the 90s.
Yeah, so that's some old school bankruptcy.
And so Tempo happens to have been one of the, like, 18 people in the world who have actually played this game back in the 90s.
Yeah.
And so we started talking about it, and, like, you know, he got me to play it, do a playthrough, and we kind of did it together. And then, because Tempo is just kind of a crazy person, he just called them up and asked if they want, like... He started calling up, like, the individuals who worked on it, like the director and the, like, sound designer and the guy who made the puppets.
That sounds like Tempo.
Like, yeah, like, just with the odds, just with the aim of getting this thing into some kind of, like, remake or re-release, because we're not even sure who has the rights to it anymore. Like, the rights to Dinotopia have reverted back to James Gurney because nobody's done anything with it for a while.
So... I mean, obviously, with like that sort of connection currently as with the art that you're doing and everything like that. Like, I mean, you obviously have a couple of your own personal projects that you're currently doing. So, what are you currently busy with? And I'm going to say currently one more time, and then hopefully that'll stop it.
I'm currently kind of ramping back up. I got busy with, you know, real life work and freelance stuff for a chunk of this year, and I'm kind of now ramping back up with the furry stuff. I have, I'm in two upcoming Dragon's Horde anthologies. I believe this is the third Nom Noms, and also one of the mainline ones. I have comics in both, and a centerfold in the more anthology. I also have a novella written for a text anthology that may or may not still be happening there.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Is this when you say Dragon's Horde, are we talking about the board game?
No. Dragon's Horde is an anthology of dragon. It's like a family of anthologies of dragon-centric stuff. Let's see if I can find it.
So I can see Magic the Gathering. I can see.
Yeah, Dragon's Horde is a card that my flatmate wants.
this Renegade Game Studios with Dragon's Horde.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's a fairly common title.
Yes.
But no, it's put together by a guy named Dreamus, who's just a great guy.
Yeah.
It's unfortunately doing anything with organizing a bunch of furry creators tends to be kind of like herding cats, even if they're not cats.
Yeah, and they're not all cats.
They could always be. Just secondary, like, I don't know, as a writer or something like that, you just, like, have a secondary cat persona.
Mm-hmm.
Sleeps every now and again and suddenly, like, has spurs of creative of juices and randomly running across. Hey?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and staring at walls as if there are ghosts.
Yeah.
I'm dropping a couple links into the Discord here. They're just... the first is where you can buy Tempo stuff, and the second is where you can buy the previous iterations of Dragon's Horde.
Yeah, these are all safe for work?
Oh, Dragon's Horde? Absolutely not. the pages themselves are. The content is not.
All right. Both... Just dropping them into chat.
Yeah, the storefronts are safe for work.
Mm. Okay. That's good. I mean... Because, I mean, like, and that's also the weird thing, isn't it? Like, I mean, when talking to Tempo, for instance, and when talking to, I guess, anybody in the furry fandom, like, a large amount of the issue in respect to creativity is that, like, pretty much, you know, the term sex sells comes up quite often.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, I mean, like, and it must be sort of, like, I don't necessarily... Maybe this would be a good question for you, is that, like, I mean, like, especially with the vast majority of the content of your artwork, like, does it ever, like, pigeonhole you in some senses? Do you ever feel
I do find it kind of does sometimes, yeah. Like, the, you know, it is hard not to look at the difference in, like, response between porn and not porn.
Yeah.
And conclude that I should probably just do porn forever.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not sure if it's, you know, just where I am, or if it's just the nature of the fandom, or the sites I post to, but, like, it just gets so much more attention.
Yeah.
And then that creates a feedback loop where, like, you know, I'm, you know, people want to see porn, so I'm making porn, so I'm only thinking about porn.
Yeah, and that is your artistic calling card, kind of.
Basically, yeah. Yeah, not that I mind porn. You know, porn has been very kind to me. You know, but like, if I'm going to put 8 hours of work into a picture and post it, I would, you know, and if I know that, you know, having a dick in there will get it 10 times the views.
Yeah. And I mean, like, beyond just, you know, furry media, for instance, like, what else are you sort of, like, working on? Like, what are the other projects that you were working on? Are they art based?
Well, the day job is taking up most of my time right now, but I want to get back into animations now that I've, like, my day job is I'm a 3D animator, and I want to get into kind of rigging and making characters and, like, doing more stuff like that, because, like, you know, I really enjoy it, and I kind of want to push my boundaries in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
Shipfolk. Do you guys remember Shipfolk? That is finally getting looked at by publishers.
Oh, nice.
Awesome.
Yeah, so hopefully we'll be seeing more of that soon.
That's cool to hear. I mean, that's been in the pipeline for quite some time. Like, the fact that I still remember it based on a conversation we had a year and a half ago, and sort of it was still in limbo. It's good to know that it's finally been picked up.
Right, yeah. And it's just such a sweet property, and we love working on it. And, like, there is so much more that exists in that world than what we have been able to put into the book. Like, you know, it started off as this weird little kind of a world building exercise almost, where, like, Tempo had this existing story about this young woman who was a spaceship. And we were like, well, maybe as a kind of, you know, exercise to figure out the details of this world, you know, we'll do a prequel where she's a little kid and you can explore around, and that will force us to figure out what this world looks like.
Hmm.
And then that just kind of became the project because it's adorable. Like, you know, this hyperactive 10-year-old with a rocket engine on her.
Oh boy.
So, like a young version of Eva?
Sort of, except she's actually human. Like, you know, she's a little kid's brain in a robot body.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's actually there's prostheses and like disability plays heavily into that the setting.
Yeah.
Where like, you know, Allison and her friends and several of the other members are all amputees, or to one degree or another, to the point where Allison has basically had her entire body amputated.
Mm-hmm.
And she just gets the awesome new robot body.
Basically, yeah. You know, and like, you know, we deal with things like, you know, oh, she could have a she could have a human body if she wanted to, but like, you know, if you ask her, she would say that having a human body would be dumb and lame. But really, she just doesn't know how to use it.
Yeah. She can't do all the cool things with a robot body that she would have done with a human one. So is it also a little bit about the idea of like exploring limitations?
Yeah, because like, you know, being in a robot body also limits her in ways that she kind of doesn't want to admit to, because you know, she can't do stuff like, she can't do a lot of just normal little kid things because she doesn't have arms and legs and
explore ice cream,
throw the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and those are like all sort of interesting nuanced points. I mean, I've been watching recently like a whole bunch of like content from like reviewers, from movie reviewers. Cinema Wins actually is what I've been watching recently, which, unlike most other groups, sort of talks about what's really good about particular movies and things like that. And
I've been seeing a lot of lately kind of a backlash against the cynical, nitpicky school of film criticism, and Cinema I really like Sims. It. I've been super into Movies with Mikey lately. I love that channel a lot. Because no matter what he's watching, he's trying really hard to find like what works about it, why people like it, why it's still remembered. Like, he's even got a side thing where he and his friends watch, you know, movies that are traditionally considered really, really bad and try to love them. Like, he just did the Dungeons and Dragons movie.
Oh, goodness me, that was a terrible movie.
Or, like, unironically, like Poltergeist or something like that.
What's that? The Stephen King movie flops.
Right, yeah.
Of which there are many.
Way to be not cynical about it.
Yeah, but I mean, like, they are flops, honestly. I mean, like, The Shining was good, and
Did you see the new It?
Yeah, It is good, obviously.
Yeah, okay, yeah. The new It was pretty good.
But then again, look at Cujo.
Yeah, well,
I mean, I think a lot of them were produced on kind of a TV budget. Like, I think a lot of them were made into TV miniseries.
That's a good way of putting it.
If that's the case, then, like, you know, Stephen King has all these, like, direct-to-video movies, except for a couple. Like, when exactly... Who's the guy who he's always up against? Like, they constantly compare the two of them quite often.
Isn't it King and Koontz?
Yes, Dean Koontz, you're right.
The only reason I know that is a Robot Chicken sketch.
Right, yeah.
But the, Yeah, the only Stephen King book I've ever read was the Gunslinger books, the Dark Tower.
Yeah.
Which is just super long. Like, my God.
Yeah. And I mean, like, when weirdly enough, while we're talking or criticizing particular sort of, like, popular media and things like that, like, one of the, obviously, like, with your books and your releases and everything like that, you do write, yeah?
I do some writing. I've written, like, parts. I've got some, like, small sections in the Windfall books. Like, just kind of, like, stuff I've spitballed that we've kind of worked back into it.
Since it's an anthology, yeah, there's room for it.
It's true. Yeah, no. I don't mean like I don't have any particular stories in this. It's more like, you know, sections and paragraphs and here and there. But it's not. But yeah, no. I enjoy writing. I have a problem. I think a lot of writers have, where I've got a lot of things started.
Yeah. I think that's everyone's problem. Like any creative has that problem.
Right. Like I've got this, you know. Like I've got the only stories I have published are my How to Train Your Dragon fan fictions. But beyond that, I've got like, I've got like two or three different settings. Just, you know, the rules all laid out and characters kind of half formed, and it's because Tempo and I love figuring out rules and like, you know, how does the world work?
Yeah.
Like how does this whole thing fit together? And that part is in some ways easier because you can just kind of freeform it. And then you go to write it and like if you haven't done any world building then it's just chaos. But if you've done too much then you're locked in. And it's an interesting
I kind of want to say it feels like the opposite. It's like you're making constraints for yourself by sort of building a world and giving it rules and then working within those constraints, because working from nothing is chaotic in and of itself.
Oh, absolutely. Like nothing is scarier than a blank canvas. You need to get something down there just so you have something to work within.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's for sure.
And then there's the trap of, like, well, I've done all this world building. I'd better jam it into whatever I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
I better have the characters stop dead and, you know, stare directly at the camera and exposit for a few minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we have a question here from Geo Home, who asks, when writing a book, how is it decided on what scenes are illustrated?
It's mostly down to, like, if when reading it, I get a strong image in my head about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, there's a scene in the first book. It's the first look at the monster. And, like, I knew right away that that was a moment I wanted to illustrate because I wanted to do something like, I wanted to do, like, a big spooky silhouette with it.
All right.
And have it be kind of mysterious. Or, like... Mm-hmm. You know, if there's like a really intimate moment or a really important moment, then I usually want to illustrate those.
Yeah.
You know, or a character that we haven't seen before.
Yeah.
That might benefit from having a clear description.
How often is that your call and how often is it like the writer's call?
Oh, no, it's I'm not sure how it would work with a normal arrangement, but here it's entirely been my call.
Okay, cool.
Like I decide, you know, like, that's a cool moment. There have even been a couple of cases where, like, I have done an illustration that didn't quite fit anything that happened, and so we kind of tweaked with the events of the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah, or, like, you know, sometimes I will do just a bunch of sketches as warm-ups, and Temple would like the looks of them, and that will inspire him to, you know, write something in or change the order of events or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. Yeah, then it's definitely more of a collaborative effort as opposed to you just being the illustrator.
Yeah, it's been weird, but yeah, I've been there since day one, and it kind of defies traditional job descriptions in the field.
Standard business practices.
I wouldn't trade it. It's been fantastic.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, collaboration is always so much better than like one person being under the thumb of the other person.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I mean, and like it's probably better to work with somebody anyway, particularly because you do have somebody who knows how your mind works. Mm-hmm. And that you can sort of spitball little ideas around, and like it improves the story overall. It allows for like somebody to have constant feedback on what's being written.
Mm. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I can imagine it must be interesting working with someone as frenetic as Tempo.
Yeah.
It's true. It's kind of like, oh, what are we working on today with Tempo?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, or like anything.
You know, yeah. Or like, we're in slightly different time zones. And so, like, you know, I'll log in on the evenings and talk to them. It's like, oh, what'd you do today? Oh, it's like, oh, I wrote, you know, 3,000 words in this entirely new story that just kind of came to me this morning.
Or, you know, I started that project and I'm like 3/4 of the way almost done.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Or like,
I have a publicist already.
I've dug this person out of obscurity and we're talking about doing a project together.
Yeah.
Sounds about right.
Or hell, not even out of obscurity. Like if you look at Tempo Talks, for instance, as well, like,
oh yeah, no,
I don't even know how the hell he gets half of those people. Like I'm just sitting here going like, wow, you did that? How?
To hear him talk, he literally just calls them.
Mm.
And that somehow works.
Turns out that's all you need to do.
Oh, hey, yeah, no, I'm doing this thing. Oh, I'm interested. How? Right. How are you interested in this?
Well, like, turns out that creative people are really gratified when people are interested in what they do.
Mm.
Who'd have guessed?
Yeah, 4 years later. But I mean, like with all of that kind of stuff, and like, I mean, like you probably talk to creatives quite a lot, and things like that. What is the one major sort of like complaint that actually comes from like working in the creative field?
I don't know if there's any like complaints that I've seen that I would, you know, cite. Being a creative on the internet is weirdly demanding because the content has to come before everything else.
Yeah.
Like, you know, with your standard 9-to-5 day job, you agree to get paid and then you do the work.
Yeah.
Whereas on the internet, it's more like you do the work and then hope you get paid.
Yeah.
It becomes a sales gig almost.
That's whole Patreon thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
I don't know, like, yeah?
Oh, no, no, go ahead.
Go right ahead, go ahead.
I've actually completely forgotten.
No, I mean, I was just sort of saying that, like, the entirety of, like, creating content for people to hopefully like and things like that, and having Patreon pages or, you know, GoFundMe or Ko-fi or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, it becomes sort of weirdly, like, scary in some senses, doesn't it? Like, I mean, I could only imagine what it feels like when, say... and I mean, like, I think it was when we spoke to like one or two of the other people, it's that entire idea that, you know, you're creating this hoping that somebody's going to like it and then not being sure whether they like it or not, by the way that, and especially by the way that the furry fandom sort of reacts to things. It's just like, you know, oh my God, this is so amazing. And you as an artist are sort of sitting there going like, you know what? It's really not my best work.
But yeah, that's happened.
Yeah.
And there's also the fact of like, I continue to search for like the golden like time to post even.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's also like, true.
You know, it's like, oh, like I posted this on a Tuesday afternoon and I did really well. And then I posted this one on a Thursday evening and it did terribly. Like, what are the rules? Somebody help me.
Yeah. I mean, that seems kind of like scary, isn't it? Like this entire idea that like, everything is beholden onto the fact that you can actually create what you need to create and what you want to create, then also sort of in some senses pander to your viewership. And I don't know, like,
I wouldn't call it pandering, never pandering, but like, it's almost like another feedback loop where knowing that people like something makes me more enthusiastic about creating it.
Mm. Okay.
That's a good way of looking at it.
Like, you know, if I pour my heart into something that nobody cares, I'm probably not going to do it again.
Yeah.
That's,
but I mean, and does like, what if there's something that you do actually really like doing and nobody seems to sort of react in the way that you want them to? Do you just drop the project or what exactly happened?
Well, maybe not drop it, but maybe like reevaluate. If it's just a matter of you posted it at a bad time and it got buried and nobody saw it, then keep working on it. And as people find and like the, you know, the next iterations, they'll go back and find the previous ones.
Yeah, fair point.
The nature of the internet is that everything's linked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, like never.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you should never do something that you actively dislike, because that's just like, if you cannot find something in a project to be enthusiastic about, that's going to come through in the final project anyway.
Yeah. And then the final project's going to be, to put it mildly.
I mean, and obviously as your own creator, for instance, like if you have all of these projects that you've started and things like that, and some things, say, for instance, like Dinotopia, sort of drop by the wayside for a while, like how do you sort of handle that sort of thing happening? And if it happens often, like how do you sort of deal with the idea that, you know, and this is not going to take the time that I want to be able to finish what I need to finish? Or that, like, again, maybe work life is getting involved and things like that. Like, how do you deal with the, I guess, how would I call that? Like, is there sort of like a kind of can't get to it depression that you might go into?
Dejection, oh, I suppose.
Yeah, dejection. Yeah,
I wouldn't call it dejection, but it's more like, oh, it's kind of like you have a workbench full of half-finished projects. And like, what you probably ought to do is clear it all off except for one and just hammer down. But you've got an idea for a new one today.
Yeah. And it's not that you can just suppress that. It's not a case of, let me briefly shelve this idea because I have to work on this thing in front of me. It's like, right. No, it's just, I have all these ideas running around in my head and I'm going to put them down on paper right now.
Right. Yeah. And like, it's easy to get down a rabbit hole without meaning to. Like, in Windfall, in the new Windfall book and going forward, we're introducing a new piece of in-universe fiction called Majestica and the Defenders of Pegastar. And it's this old this old 80s cartoon of, in the He-Man, She-Ra vein.
Okay.
And and the idea is that, like, you know, in-universe Laura, the mom of one of the main characters, is reviving it.
Yeah.
And so we've put kind of an absurd amount of effort into figuring out, like, you know, both what the production of the original run looked like and like what the show itself was. Like, we've got character lineups, we've got history and motivations, and like the, you know, and then we've got to figure out like how's that different in the new one. And it's almost like, like there's enough there to be a book on its own, and it's just going to be background, and it's because it's fun to think about, and it's it's entertaining to kind of bounce these back and forth, and like, you know, look at things that were popular in the 80s and just kind of hammer them in because it was all just signed to sell toys.
Yeah, fair enough.
So yeah, it's dangerous, but also a lot of fun to get into the weeds like that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are only so many hours in the day, and you do have an actual book to write at some point.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's why the role of a producer exists.
Mm-hmm.
Like artists will sit and do their thing forever and ever and ever, but eventually a product has to go out the door.
Yes, exactly.
So I mean, and with that, like obviously you mentioned that you work as a designer in your sort of work life as well. Like, does it ever feel like you're sort of, when you come home from work, does it ever feel like, you know, because both your private and public sort of persona in essence sort of revolves around this idea of designing characters and designing particular things, do you ever feel burnt out just by doing that every single day, all day?
Sometimes a little bit. If I get home from work and it's been a long day of making creative decisions and just kind of going, so I will often just kind of not have much to throw at the art. But also there are areas where there's not a lot of overlap. Like you mentioned designing characters, and that's not really something I get to do. Like, and so making those kinds of decisions, like coming up with like what a character looks like and how they behave and, you know, how they relate to other characters, that is something that I still really enjoy doing, even on days where I've spent the whole day animating.
Yeah. So, and with the animation work, for instance, like, I mean, obviously we can't necessarily get too deeply into it, but like, what are the projects that you've worked on in respect to that?
Mostly shows for, you know, quite small children at this point, but the, like, I've learned a lot from working at this job, and it's something that I want to put back into the fandom.
Yeah.
Where like, if I can get my hands on some models or learn to make them myself, then like I could do something really cool. And it's, you know, the problem is like I'm a 3D animator now, and there's a lot of pre-production involved. Like I can't just, you know, whip something up and start doing it.
Mm.
I am pretty good at several stages of the process. Like I can model a character, I can texture it, I can animate it, but I cannot rig it. And so that's something I need to figure out now.
Yeah, and
what does rigging entail?
A 3D character is basically papier-mâché or like origami. Like it's a shell of polygons, and they're controlled from within by bones, and every bone has like a certain amount of points on that character that are assigned to it. And so when the bone moves, those points move, and it looks like the character is moving.
Mm.
And then that and adding controls to those bones so they're easy to work with, and like, you know, all the controls that make a character move, that's rigging. Mm.
It's the strings to the puppet.
Basically, yeah. Ooh. Yeah, all and right. it's, yeah, and like, you know, the program that I work in these days, I don't know how to do that in.
Which one?
All right.
Yeah, I'm currently working in Maya. Up until then, for years I worked in 3D Studio Max, and it's very different, but Max isn't nearly as good for animating, so I would want to do anything going forward in Maya.
Oh, okay.
Hmm.
I have a friend who also really loves working in Maya. But yeah, he's struggling to find a job in 3D because he's currently in retail. Poor guy.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Well, it happens. Like, you know, the world doesn't always line up with what we need it to be.
Yeah, and it always feels like creatives get the short end of the stick, unfortunately.
Yeah, like the reality is that when you enjoy what you do, people will assume you like. Don't need things like money.
Yeah.
Exposure.
Yeah. God.
Every time I said that word to a creative, it's like, oh, go soak your head. Go away.
No, because every creative has had someone come along like, hey, I'm doing this like really elaborate, time-consuming thing. You'll do that for free, right?
Yep.
Wow.
And usually it's it's a huge red flag, not only for the business practice, but because it betrays that the person doesn't know what they're talking about in terms of what they're asking you to do.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Like this person has no idea what's the scale of work that's going into whatever they're asking you to do.
Exactly.
Hmm.
And so like, yeah, it's just something everybody has to learn to deal with. And, you know, you got to learn to put your foot down. Like, no, I will not work for free. So yeah. You know, just because I enjoy what I'm doing doesn't mean my time isn't worth money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't buy food with exposure.
Exactly.
Hmm. Okay. So, and I mean, like, I space out a little bit now. Sorry. But like when you sort of work on like projects like that, and I mean, obviously you're working with children's like animation and things like that. And like, modeling, like how different do you think like companies or big animation companies are now in comparison to what they used to be, say in the sort of like, you know, still hand-drawn modeling stuff? Like is there like, do the timelines extend or have they gotten like shorter instead?
As far as timelines are concerned, I think it's more or less the same across the whole board, but it's now divided into departments because, like, you know, in a big 3D production, like modeling and rigging and texturing and then animating and then compositing and lighting and finalizing and everything. Those are all separate departments.
Yeah. Post effects, 3D, everything.
Right. Exactly. And it's a huge elaborate production, but you know, it's also like a really cool, well-oiled machine that I would miss if I didn't have it in a future production.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, I understand that.
Like, to always know what you're supposed to be working on, when it is due, who you're reporting to on it, who has touched it last, who will touch it after you.
Yeah. Mm. I think we had
There's like an upside and a downside to both of that. It's like, that idea of just like throwing something over the wall when you're done with it kind of thing. It's like, yeah, it goes out of your hands, but then sort of your impact on it is a little bit limited. But yeah, that's, yeah, encoding, that's definitely a thing that you want to avoid, because you want to ensure that everyone understands what everything does, I suppose.
But yeah, although I found that one thing that I've struggled with since coming to work there is, like, as an animator, I will work on something until somebody physically takes it away from me. Like, yeah. if there's something that I want to be perfect, you know, it's set up in a way that I can literally just, you know, keep working on it until the deadline, and then somebody comes along and says, "You are not allowed to work on that anymore. It's going to the client. Move on."
Mom.
Basically, and it had, even if it's not perfect, and that kind of got me into trouble with the cover for Windfall 2, because I wanted it to be perfect, and it turns out there was nobody but me saying when it was going to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Oh boy.
Yeah. So it took a little longer than I intended it to, but. Did we talk about Windfall in this iteration of the podcast?
I don't even think we've gotten there, really.
We haven't touched on it yet.
Oh, yeah, because we had that little hiccup.
Mm. Yeah.
All right, so that's
as good. I mean, what? Then. No, nothing happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, nothing.
Everything has been perfect forever.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, no, that's as good a segue as any into talking about Windfall 2, which is coming out at Midwest Fur Fest in like 10 days, and will thereafter be available online. It's it's a sequel to the first one, obviously. Windfall 2. The full title is The Otter Body Experience and Other Short Stories, because it's an anthology.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, somebody already mentioned that. Like when I was putting out the advertising for today's podcast, mm-hmm. somebody was like, "Oh goodness me, otter puns."
Tempo freaking loves puns.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah, no, they're great. They're great. It shows good. What do you call it? Not really so much penmanship as wordsmanship.
And so like the stories deal with the fallout from the events of the first book and setting up events for future books. They take place over roughly a year after the first book.
Yeah.
And like some of the stories have been posted online previously. A lot of them are new, including like the Otter Body Experience itself, which is a novella that takes up about half the entire book.
Yeah.
About that's the one about the magical snap bracelets, right? Or something like that.
Yeah,
and so there is, there is. Yeah, lost my train of thought. But there's a lot of threads.
Yeah.
A lot of threads to pick up. A lot of like cool character stuff. A lot of ideas that have been percolating for literally years. Finally got onto the page, because like it's really easy to come up with like, you know, hey, here's a funny scene, or here's a cool thing that could happen. It's a lot harder to figure out where that fits in a narrative.
Mm. Yeah.
No, that's completely understood. Sorry, go ahead, Eric.
So, no. I was just thinking, like, I mean, when it comes to sort of creating these worlds of that kind of magnitude, and I know that. I think it's been one of the things that we've found quite often with all the writers and creators that we've sort of spoken to over the years, is that entire idea that like you come up with one idea for something and then it just sort of recreates itself and continually just moves forward and forward and forward. And like, is there ever a point that you ever feel like the story could ever stop?
I think the story's where it has to stop sometimes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause at the rate that I write, it would take me, 10 years to write a Game of Thrones length book. Mm-hmm. But no, it's more about you figure out what the characters are trying to do,
mm-hmm.
what they have to learn, like how they grow and change, and then you almost kind of work it back and forth where you. You know, start from the beginning and then figure out where you begin, and then you figure out the logical progression of events. And then maybe you have to, maybe that means you have to go back, you know, like just kind of back and forth over and over again, smoothing things out and finding the details. You know, like
covering the plot holes.
Basically. And like you figure out, you know, where stuff fits and where stuff could go. And it's like, oh, where stuff ought to go, except now you got to move stuff around because it's perfect if it goes there, but that makes it, this other part not make sense anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, otherwise, like, everything's just disjointed and it seems a little bit roughshod, kind of.
Exactly.
It's always sort of this mind map that you have to draw for yourself with regards to your own story, because you can't keep everything in your head. Like, imagine imagine trying to make, like a murder mystery or something, or a whodunit backwards. Like, you start at, this guy killed the thing, and then...
that actually works, because then you start off with, you know, yes, you know, this guy killed this other guy, but then you have to figure out why.
Yeah.
So you, you know, your veterans are there, and then, like, you figure out what happened, and then you figure out how the good guys find out about that, and in what stages.
Yeah.
A big hurdle is you want to avoid like arbitrary stuff or deus ex machina, where stuff just kind of comes out of nowhere, or stuff is suddenly introduced that you need to stop them, you know, stop the plot and face the audience and explain it for a few minutes.
Yeah. And then it then it becomes the end of Monty Python, the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
Right. Like that was, you know,
anticlimactic.
Oh, super intentional, but yeah.
Yeah, but it, you know, they were kind of taking the piss out of that sort of thing where it's like, you know, the plot has now ground to a halt and we've lost all momentum in the narrative because the audience doesn't have information they need to understand what's about to happen.
Yeah. So let's just smash the fourth wall. I remember I think it was an episode of Tabletop with Will Wheaton. And they were playing Fiasco, which is this like dice-driven RPG. Mm-hmm. And they had a writer on there. I think it was Patrick Rothfuss. I'm unsure. Mm-hmm. But he mentioned something like three questions to ask yourself as a writer, which I kind of found interesting. It's like, who wants what? Why can't they have it? And why should I give a shit? It's like those three questions will sort of immediately facilitate a story, even if it's just like in an RPG.
Interesting.
Do you there's actually a question here again from Geo Holmes asking, what was the inspiration for Windfall, and perhaps related the inspirations for Max and Kylie?
Max and Kylie are kind of like, this is really great. You know, we liked the idea of this team who has been working together for their entire lives, or you know, for a few years at least in this case. Like, they're already super close at the beginning of the story, but not in a... It's almost like a boy next door kind of romance, but it's, you know, instead of just having grown up near one another, they've already got this big experience together, they work well as a team, they know each other, and then the romance happens.
Yeah.
Like, we found that to be an interesting change of pace. And, like, as far as Windfall, it was initially going to be kind of more about them as actors. And, like, you know, we had ideas for, like, a lot of, like, you know, drama with Max's family. And it was all kind of heavy. And then we thought, like, well, what if instead these two are working together and it's, you know, something else is happening. Like, they are, you know, trying to solve a mystery. All right, well, what kind of mystery? What if it's goddamn paranormal? Like, what if it's like, you know, what if there's like all this weird stuff in this little town and like, you know, neither of them really know what's going on because neither of them grew up there, but there's, you know, so they're outsiders, but they're trying to solve a mystery and they're also falling in love and it's just like a lot going on and it provides us a lot of cool, wacky opportunities and, you know, space for interesting things to happen and interesting characters. And it lets the whole town be just kind of full of weirdos. And that's always fun. And it just made the whole, you know, instead of just being a romance, it's now a romance with paranormal elements, and that just gives us so much room, more room to play.
Do you think Scooby-Doo had any kind of influence to it?
Scooby-Doo wasn't really what we had in mind when we were watching it. It was more, I think Buffy was an inspiration, Twin Peaks, Gravity Falls.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, Kylie's mother Laura has a lot of Grunkle Stan in her.
Yeah.
And like, but I wouldn't really say Scooby-Doo, because it's like, in Scooby-Doo, the monsters aren't real.
Yeah.
Usually. Unless it's the movies.
Don't even want to talk about those. Scrappy-Doo turning into a muscled Hulk. What the fuck?
No, man. No. It's genius. Everybody hates Scrappy-Doo anyway, so they just made him the bad guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like old English shit.
I don't know. Like, it was a good movie. I kind of liked it. The transformation sequence for Scrappy-Doo was actually pretty interesting. Especially considering that they kept his legs tiny as shit.
Yeah, that was pretty fun. But yeah, like, I think, like, when you're a kid and you take Scooby-Doo kind of seriously and you watch the movie, it doesn't really work. But as an adult, knows that Scooby-Doo is always kind of tongue-in-cheek, I think it works a lot better.
Mm. Like, like the supernatural crossover with Scooby-Doo was very much like that.
I haven't seen that, but I want to so bad. Like, it seems so perfect. Do it.
Yeah.
Like, I know there's an angle where, like, you know, Dean wants to preserve the purity of the characters, and I think that's adorable.
Yeah. Yeah, and there is one scene where, like, the gang has an existential crisis, and that's hysterical.
Yeah. I actually like the reboot of the Scooby-Doo, like the animated
version. I've heard it's good. There have been a few versions.
It's not bad. Like, but I mean, like, the most recent reboot, like, 2016?
Okay, yeah, because, like, we tend to think of classic Scooby-Doo as just being one thing, but there's actually, like, five different shows.
Yeah, five different groups of people. There's the one where, what was it, that they had, like, possibly the best horror narrator on Earth.
Boris Karloff? Right.
Hey, no, man, they. How do I forget his name?
Winston Price.
There we go. Yeah,
there we are.
Winston Price.
Vincent.
There's a statement here that does say that best Scooby-Doo movie is Zombie Island, hands down.
I've heard that one's really good. I don't think I've ever seen it.
Mm.
Like, I was kind of growing out of that stage of cartoons when the made for TV movies come around. I did see the one with the aliens.
I rarely follow Scooby-Doo movies, so I'll take your word for it.
Oh, I love Scooby-Doo. I just don't watch the movies because I'm too busy watching YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Inspiration for everything, unfortunately. So, I mean, like, what exactly would you consider your influences to be? I mean, like, your artwork obviously shows a couple of interests that you possibly have, or are those just things that, like, fan people ask for that?
Little column A, little column B. I certainly enjoy doing it. In terms of artistic influences, I'm in a weird place right now where I'm simultaneously aping Nomax and Brayburned, which are, like, and Nomax has this really great, like, painterly style with really strong lighting. And Brayburn, by contrast, is this super simple style that you can knock out in a few minutes, but it still gets a lot of character across. And so, kind of depending on what I want to do, those are the two that I'm chasing at the moment. But, like, historically, I like kind of impressionism, but not realism. Like, I want to evoke emotion and lighting, but I don't really want to disguise that it's a painting kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I understand that.
So, I mean, your work is rather realistic if one sort of thinks about like proportions and everything like that. It's I don't know, maybe it skirts the line between cartoony and more sort of realism.
Well, yeah, because with furries you got to be real careful, because, like, it's easier to draw them and to get away with, like, you know, the stereotype is that, you know, people draw furries because they can't draw humans. because there's a ton of like
the uncanny valley sets in very quickly. If you're drawing humans,
yeah, like the human face is really finicky because we spend all day looking at them and we know when something's not right.
Yeah,
and so putting human features on an animal gives you a lot of leeway. It's like making a cartoon character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so if you're like, if you put too much realistic detail onto a an animal head, or too much realistic human detail anyway, it starts to look really creepy. And so yeah, I'm kind of chasing the line between where, like, you know, if I just put an actual dog head on Max, he's got no emotion.
Yeah.
Dogs can emote to a degree, but not to the degree that I need. But if I make him look too human, or like, if I make him look too simple, then he stops, it stops being consistent with the tone of the book. And if I, make him look too human, then it starts looking creepy. Like, so yeah, there's a lot of, it's a juggling act, but I really enjoy it.
Because, that will probably just, because I can use this as a segue, like, you've probably seen the Pokemon trailer now recently.
Oh, mm-hmm. Detective Pikachu. Action.
I'm super Detective stoked. Pikachu. I'm not going to lie.
I'm pretty stoked as well, like, very quietly about it. Mm-hmm. But obviously the question's going to be, because that's pretty much been the massive debate about it in the first place, is like, does the animation style do justice? Does it do everything that it's meant to do?
Well, they've got a particular juggling act because they've got a brand to maintain.
Yeah.
So, like, if you want to make a realistic Pikachu, maybe you make him look a little bit more like a mouse, but then he doesn't look enough like a Pikachu to be recognizable as a Pikachu.
Yeah.
And he's just a mouse with a messed up tail.
Mm.
Yep.
So I think the kind of living plush toy aesthetic they've gone with is the best they could have done with those constraints. Yeah.
Yes, definitely.
I mean, with the what's the word? The quality of actor that they have so far from what I've seen, mm-hmm. like it really does sort of like, it lends itself very well to the kind of expressions that they can do in respect to the film itself.
Right. And like the kind of story they're telling is a smart choice because it lends itself to kind of a limited cast. Like, so they can focus more on making a few really good things than a lot of kind of terrible ones.
Yeah.
But also I'm really intrigued by the fact that there's just kind of, they're taking the world for granted almost.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they aren't saying like, behold peasants, we have made a movie with Pokemon in it. They're just kind of like, no, it's Pokemon. We know it's
yeah.
Like, yeah. We have all fantasized about living in this world. It is people and Pokemon living together.
But not everybody's a trainer.
Yeah. We're going to tell a story around that.
Like, it's sort of like the start of, like Pacific Rim, the world is already there, like, and we've built the world in our own heads over the past, what, 2 decades? This is just playing off in what you know, essentially.
Exactly. Like, we are natural. Just going to tell a story that is in this world. The story is not about the world.
Yep.
Yeah, and it probably does very well for that fact, particularly because, like, when you're building this entire story around it, you can use all of the elements, but you don't have to, like, have hours and hours of expose about, you know, this particular character. Say you did it on Red, or for instance, as your main protagonists, or Ash, for instance. Like, you can't, it's not the same story. You need to have, like, for a large amount of the stuff, you need to have that, like, background knowledge of what happened in the series before you understand, like, what's going on. Yeah.
Like, if you watch, say, Pokemon the first movie,
yeah,
like, the whole draw of that movie was it was a Pokemon movie.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, basically it was just like a long and elaborate episode of the TV show. But if you came into the, if you sat down in that movie and didn't know what Pokemon was, you'd be completely lost.
Yes. Yeah.
Because everything depends on everything else and nothing is ever explained.
Mm.
And, but like, I feel like in this movie, you just kind of have the premise of, you know, yes, there are people, there are also magical monsters.
Like, deal.
And it's just, yeah, it's just a thing. You don't need to know about that to understand what's going on, because this guy's looking for his father and this Pikachu can talk, and that's, and you know that's weird because the guy's freaking out about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, it's more like, you know, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Yeah. Where, like, yes, this world has some weird rules, but there are still normal people in it. And those are good, those are the people we're looking at here.
Ah, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? What a good movie!
It is. It's fantastic, and it's fantastic because it's a story and not just a world.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
they set the frame. They yeah.
No, go ahead, Ivic. Did they set the frame?
No, I was just saying that like they set the frame for it so well in that like you're kind of launched into this world without necessarily knowing what exactly is going on, but in that same sense, mm-hmm. like the first 5 minutes of it almost explains it immediately.
Yeah,
right, exactly. And like, you know, they do they work it into character where we are learning about tunes in the same instant we are learning that, you know, Eddie doesn't like tunes.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like if you've ever seen a cartoon, you're immediately, you know what, what's up, what's the draw here. But yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And like, and, you know, yeah. we're 2 decades in on Pokemon. Everybody who's going to see this movie knows about Pokemon already.
Everyone has at least seen the little yellow Taser rat.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Also, like something about Roger Rabbit that I really liked is there's a turn of phrase that came out of it in the animation industry called bumping the lamp.
Yes. Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah, the idea is so cool.
Yeah, like for listeners who don't know, there's a scene in Who Framed Roger Rabbit where they're trying to get the handcuffs off, and Eddie he's got his hand on a box, and he's trying to use a hacksaw on the handcuffs, and yeah. Roger is flipping all over the place and being a spastic weirdo because it's Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
And during the scene, the lamp gets knocked. And it continues to, like, it's one of those hanging lamps because it's a 40s movie.
Hanging ceiling lamp, anyway. Ceiling lamp, yeah.
Yeah. And it swings wildly for the rest of the scene. And it's just this, like, perfectly natural thing that would happen if a character is, you know, flailing around like a spastic weirdo in an enclosed space. But the thing is, Roger Rabbit isn't actually in the room.
Yeah.
So really, somebody else came in and hit that lamp to make it swing around. And then infinitely complicated production because they had all these, like, moving shadows for the entire rest of the scene that they had to animate on Roger Rabbit. Jeez, and it was so much more difficult than it needed to be, but it made that scene feel so natural that you never thought about it.
Yeah.
Like, it made him feel like part of the world, and so it became the shorthand for, you know, the extra detail that makes the whole thing work.
Yeah, go the extra mile to make sure that, like, the immersion isn't broken and this just feels real.
Mm.
Yeah, and it's just like it was a testament to the commitment that they had to that project because like it was one of the last gasps for Disney Animation in the 80s. Like, it was one of the things responsible for turning the studio around because they'd had a rough couple of decades.
I mean, yeah, they could have just reshot that scene and not have the lamp, like, just have the lamp be stationary, have the actors be a bit aware of it. But they didn't. Like, they went above and beyond to make that scene feel as natural as possible.
Right, and so, like, a modern equivalent of that is in the Jungle Book movie from a couple of years ago, which I really liked, on the set, because most of the movie is filmed in green screen, and obviously, you know, basically every character except Mowgli is CG.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what they did is they had these, like, elaborate puppets that they would have on set of the animals' heads. And they were there specifically for the kid to act against.
Yeah.
Because, like, you can't have a 10-year-old act against tennis balls.
Yeah.
Mm.
Imagination notwithstanding, it's difficult.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, and, like, it's I think it's that kind of dedication. It's one of the reasons why glad to have you and Tempo on, particularly because the way that you sort of talk about the work that you guys are doing and the kind of, like, elaboration that you do for, you know, the things that you're working on, it's commendable, particularly because you can do a lazy job and get away with it.
Like, Tempo and I share a belief that if you go into a project with a cynical mindset, you are ultimately going to kill it.
Yep.
You will strangle it to death if you are chasing trends or doing things just because you think it's going to make money. There has to be something within the project that you care about.
You do not know how relevant that is to my current situation.
And, like, do tell.
No, like, just work shit in general. Like, the kind of stuff we're putting out is very, wouldn't call it cash grabby, but it's a little bit soulless and less That's kind of, yeah.
Right. And like, so sometimes you have to work on it. Sometimes you have to kind of dig a little to find something within a project. Like if you're being forced to work on something, like there have been projects at my job that I haven't super cared about, but what you do is you find elements within it that you do care about. Or like, you know, maybe it's something that only you care about. Maybe it's something that's not even real. Maybe you have to make up a dumb joke behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And then like, you're just picturing that the whole time you're working. It's like, this, you know, it's like, I've decided that this character is secretly a serial killer off screen. And unbeknownst to everybody else, I'm going to treat them like that.
Yeah. Like we, there was this one game that we were making was just sort of like a, I don't know if you know sort of Jones in the Fast Lane, like that old Sierra game from like the floppy disk era, essentially. Anyway, like we're doing something like that and just sort of managing your funds and making sure you're healthy and all that stuff. And there was something happened along the way where we were just testing and the character was like really sick, so we sent her to the clinic and she just took some of the like the cheap like over the counter painkillers and then she died. And then there's just this like morbid story of this woman who's working herself to death in like in her early 20s and then she just takes a bunch of painkillers and dies.
Like, oh.
And that was sort of the running gag with this manic looking woman in the like in the game.
All right then.
I don't know why, but I just found that to be like really funny.
Huh.
It's like emergent story through bugs, essentially.
Jeez. I mean, and like when it comes to that kind of perspective, if I'm looking at the chat right now, Trace is talking about Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and it's a pretty impressive movie. And then I mentioned, you know, when we look at the premise of what was going on there, Who Framed Roger Rabbit was the perfect way to do something like that. However, then like the next movie that was of the same sort of made from the same kiln, I guess, would have been Space Jam. And Space Jam was kind of bad in the fact that it kind of destroyed that particular type of magic.
Not
that Space Jam is bad. I'm honestly like, I mean, I say this, but you know, I'm a big fan. I used to like when I was a kid, we were actually still in America and they bought Space Jam for me. I would watch that movie over and over. Like, I think I've probably watched Space Jam at least 40, 50 times.
Mm-hmm. Like Space Jam, I would say its biggest sin is cynicism. You know, it was kind of created as this weird promotional vehicle for Michael Jordan, and it, like, it doesn't really seem to care about the characters at all. Like, nothing really happens with, like, all right. If you look at the old, you know, like, not I'm going to sound super old here, but if you, like, for the record, I was, like, 8 when Space Jam came out.
Yeah,
I'm totally on board with Space Jam. But, like, you know, when if you look at like the classic cartoons that are the reason that everybody loves these characters, you know, you would never get a joke where Porky Pig pisses himself.
that's just
kind of lazy and standard, and that's kind of that whole movie.
Yeah, true. Like, and the fact that they have to like go down a level in like cartoon standards by playing something as like on the nose and known to everyone as basketball. It's like,
And I mean, like, and then pandering to fart jokes and like run on gags.
Right. And it doesn't matter because we're going to promote the hell out of it. All the little kids are going to go see it and they won't know the difference anyway. But that kind of thing matters. It's the difference between remembering something like Space Jam and remembering something like Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yeah. Not that as a kid you should have actually been watching Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Oh, I did.
It was literally one of those movies that I still remember. I had nightmares.
Well, the shoe, yeah.
Yeah.
The shoe and the guy at the end with the eyes. Those eyes.
Yeah, the eyes freaked me the hell out.
That was it was memorable. That was memorable in that particular thing. Yes, it was a kid's movie made by Disney. that literally, like, sort of, it sets a tone, doesn't it? I mean, like, that was done God knows how many years ago. Fact of the matter is we still remember it, firstly. Secondly, we're probably all emotionally scarred by it. But thirdly, it was a story that was so well written and so well executed that, like, you have to remember it. It has to be written down as one of the best movies of its kind.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Right, yeah, exactly. And, like, you know, you mentioned, you know, being traumatized by it, and I absolutely think that's what we remember it days, because like I am a big believer in making a character earn their happy ending.
Yeah.
And, like, you have to have, you know,
a believable,
right? Because, like, if the only how to phrase this, if the only obstacle between your hero and his goals is that he hasn't bothered to go to accomplish them yet, it's not a narrative, it's a grocery shopping.
Yeah, it's a list item,
right? Like, there needs to be, you know, things both within and without your characters that are holding them back that they have to get past. There has to be, you know, trials and tribulations and setbacks, because that's where the story lives. That's where things happen.
Yeah. Geo Holmes is asking all the, like, really cool questions.
Go, Geo Holmes.
Were there challenges in doing what they assume from the title, in doing the body swap plot?
Challenges, certainly, but fun ones. It's, you know, like, setting up situations where, you know, the characters, like, you know, what was really interesting is that these are characters who are well aware of what a body swap storyline is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this isn't a universe where people have never seen movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, where nobody doesn't know what the zombie apocalypse is going to be.
Right, and so, like, you know, it takes them a while to adjust to being body swapped, but it doesn't take them long to realize that they have been body swapped, you know? Like, they know, and so it becomes more about working around it than figuring it out, and, like, yeah. You know, it's like they, you know, so you get, like, Kylie going crazy because, you know, for the first time in her life, she is above the median height, and she can like rip the, you know, she can rip a door off its hinges if she wants to.
And so there
was a ton of interesting character stuff we could do, because, you know, Max defines his personality in large part by being able to protect people, and he can't do that as a 5-foot otter. And so where does that leave him? And, like, you know, Kylie is accustomed to being able to just kind of, like, you know, run around and, you know, kind of be in people's faces and, like, you know.
Yeah, her, like, she's not as intimidating as Max would be.
Kind right, of like, but, like, yeah. She's used to being able to do stuff because she's not intimidating.
Yeah.
Because, like, if Max, you know, charges to full speed across the room to get in somebody's face, that's a, you know, he could kill somebody. That's a serious threat.
Hmm.
You know, but when Kylie does it, it's kind of adorable.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm like, character development is literally one of the major things. It's one of the things that I continually going back to now with the cinema wins that I've been sort of talking about is the fact that, like, if a character can, irrespective of the fact that they have particular flaws, for instance, keep the magic of those flaws going. Because at the end of the day, like, a large amount of the movies that we've seen very, very recently is the entire idea that all of our characters are flawed in one way or another.
Oh, and then the entire premise for BoJack Horseman.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Right. Like, but I mean, really find BoJack Horseman kind of hard to watch because, like, yes, he's flawed, but he's also not trying.
Yes.
Like, I love characters with flaws. I love characters with shortcomings, but they have to be trying. Yeah. And to watch BoJack Horseman make the same mistake over and over again, you know, it's just kind of depressing. And so I kind of disengaged.
But it's part of the issue that he faces, the fact that he never learns.
Okay, but like, why am I watching then? If failure is inevitable, why should I watch?
But there's small bits of growth, one would think. But then again, like if that's the case, for the vast majority of us who know a little bit about BoJack Horseman, like, and I, Scratch and I had this argument before, like, mm-hmm. I find a large amount of like my own insecurities in the way that BoJack Horseman is. And Scratch actually said, like, the reason why he isn't necessarily you in sort of very many cases is the entire idea that, like, he doesn't learn from his mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And the very fact that he doesn't learn from his mistakes makes him the character that he is. The very fact that you, like, and it's never that clear-cut idea that if I'm going to do something to fix something, that I'm not going to make the same mistake again. Especially if you're living in the kind of dystopian sort of like mindset that BoJack Horseman has. It's his flaw as well as his greatest strength, in the fact that he will constantly do the same thing over and over again and never learn from the mistakes that he makes. Mm-hmm. Very much like most humans do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, BoJack Horseman's heavy.
I haven't watched season, what is it, 4 now? 5?
Yeah, 5. I seem to get on that.
I don't... Sure, not now.
Yeah.
If I had to watch BoJack Horseman now, I'd... Next week's Sunday may not necessarily be something we can do.
Oh no.
Oh damn.
I'd spend my entire fucking day just like curled up in bed and just having existential crisis after existential crisis.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, and yep. Jeez. But I mean, like, but that's the magic of the storylines. And as a writer and a creator yourself, like, it's something that needs to be sort of seen for the work that you do. Like, it's easy to write porn, for instance. I mean, mm-hmm. boy meets girl, or girl meets girl, boy meets boy, boy meets
person with genitals meets person with genitals.
Yes.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, and something contrived happens and they have fun. Mm-hmm. Fun. I'm sorry.
That was a bit of a Freudian slip if I ever heard one.
Let's have fuck. Let's do that. No. But I mean, like, it's easy to do that, particularly because, like, if you look at the vast majority of, like, you know, anything that is in any way sort of created around just that, like, you'll find that the storylines get very, very bad. Mm-hmm. And yet, look even at something like, you know, 50 Shades of Grey. You kind of sit going like, well, the entire storyline is contrived because it's literally boy meets girl. Boy is super strong. Girl is insecure about almost everything that she has. Fuck happens.
Are we talking about the Twilight series or?
No. 50 Shades of Grey.
Okay, I was confused by the boy's really strong part.
Yeah, no. Well, all right. Regardless. Confusion is natural because mm-hmm. 50 Shades of Grey began life as Twilight fanfiction.
Yeah.
And so she basically just replaced is a vampire with is a billionaire.
Yeah. Which literally just doesn't actually change the plot at all. But that's the entire thing. Like, to be able to write a good fiction like that, and it's something that I've noticed that Tempo does so well, is the fact that, like, they draw you in to the point that that progression is the natural one, the one that will happen.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Not the contrived.
Yeah, not the, like, I'm a plumber, you're a lady, hello.
No,
oh,
I...
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, no, I definitely prefer my porn to have an element of character where, like, you know, I find it easier to care about the porn when I care about the character and have, you know, a reason to want them to have a fuck.
to give one too, I guess. No, I'm done. Okay, carry on.
Are you truly now?
Okay, but like, and it's got a lot to do with the way that you guys sort of create your characters. Like, I mean, like, and there are many, many comics that I've read out there that I kind of sit there going like, oh, you know, now they're doing this. And it's like 20 pages worth of what they're doing. And eventually I'm kind of sitting there going like, can you guys get back to the like plot line? Because the plot line was far more important to me than what you guys are currently doing.
Right. Or like, yeah, you got to be real careful with that where, you know, you got to make sure the sex scenes like flow naturally from the progression. And that is definitely a trap you fall into, like writing, say, you know, stuff on a furry site where there's this kind of unspoken expectation that the climax will contain a climax. And it's kind of hard to worry, like work the story around that. Like,
yeah,
you know, when maybe it would be more natural if there wasn't a sex scene at all, or if it happened halfway through the story. But then if you put the sex scene halfway through the story, will people even read the rest of it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because then you're halfway through the book and you're like, okay, that's where I want to.
Yeah. People will tune like the, out. The way the...
Yeah. But then again, look at something like 50 Shades of Grey again. There are very many pictures that I used to see on Twitter where people were reading the book and they had little earmarks for every single point that they wanted to read again. I'm kind of sitting there going like, okay, cool. I mean, it's a novel, but now you're picking out scenes.
Was it just the sex scenes?
Yeah. It looked like one of those like old school library catalogs where you'd like have all the indentations.
Oh, right.
Like A B C D E F G H I J, yeah. Like, and all of them would have their little like, down the It looked like that. But little like tape like plastic little taped on like markers.
Right. Yeah. Wow.
It was entertaining, at least.
Well, like, you know, and the reason, you know, like, even 50 Shades of Grey kind of suffers from that, because it started life as, like, not just, like, Twilight, you know, like, it's not just, you know, Twilight fan fiction. It was serialized Twilight fan fiction. It was, like, a weekly published thing. And so you get a lot of plot points that start and stop, and sex scenes that don't really accomplish anything or matter to the characters at all. And, like... Mm-hmm. And there was, they just felt no need to edit those things out because turns out that's what a certain audience wanted to see.
Yeah. And like, as again, like as a writer, like, and you guys have seen this, or at least I've seen it when I'm looking at both of your works, is the fact that you guys take absolute pride in what you're doing. And again, that brings us back to that entire thing, is invest yourselves in your characters.
Yes, absolutely. And, like, this stuff's important to us. We work hard on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hard on.
Boo.
Sorry.
Get off the stage.
Wouldn't be the first time I've been booed off stage. Metaphorically speaking.
Yeah. Yeah, there we go. So, I mean, L Jot says, you know, 50 Shades of Grey was interesting in a way. It was the only open. No, not safe for work book that people read in mass and in public.
Right. Like that was weird. Like it hit a critical mass where you were just allowed to look at it. Like,
yeah.
Everybody knew what it was and you were reading it anyway.
And you knew what it was going to do.
Yeah.
Imagine doing that on the train.
Yeah, people did that. Some of the people were reading that stuff on the train.
That's the power of It's the power of a classy cover, I think.
Yeah.
Like, Muslim Boo like kind of style.
Like, if the cover had been, you know, like, Anna draped across Christian's, like, chiseled abs, you know, with some weird gossamer ribbon thing in the background, and the title's this big, elaborate silver font, then everybody would...
Comic Sans.
Yeah, everybody would... Like, everyone would be a lot more... judgmental about it, but because it's like ooh, it's like a domino mask, and it's shot in profile, and it's like classy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah.
Too bad about the contents.
Hell yeah.
So I mean, do you ever feel like, I mean, we spoke a little bit about pigeonholing a little bit earlier. Like with all of the projects that you guys have, is there ever a point that you're going to sort of like focus? Like more heavily into one or two particular projects that you're working on? Is there anything in the future?
Well, we've got a couple things that we're not quite ready to discuss yet.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're Like, I'm not sure what you mean. Like
beyond just the release of wow, I'm bad with titles.
Windfall 2. Names.
Yes, Windfall 2. Like, what is the next step? Now that that's sort of out of the way, you guys are probably going to do a couple of, like, you know, promotional things for it. But, like, what's mm-hmm. next in the pipeline?
Well, I think Tempo's kind of recuperating at the moment. But next we have, you know, Windfall 3. Tempo's got the next Six is Wild in the works, too. We've got this really cool thing that might take a while, but it's, you know, we're not quite ready to talk about. And, like, I've got some stories I want to write. I've got some comics. I've got a lot of kind of half-baked. Like, I you know, like I said, I want to maybe try to get some animations done if I can get a character together that can support it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. And, like, yeah, it'll probably be kind of semi-experimental where, you know, I, like, use a character to learn to model and then, you know, to learn to rig a character because I do know how to model already.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kind of, you know, make that porn as well.
maybe not. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, if I'm making a character anyway, I might as well make him have a dick.
Wow. Here's a very interesting question. Now, considering that it's especially on furry Twitter where we're talking a lot more about trans rights and things like that,
uh-huh.
like, do you think that writers are beginning to move into that sort of perspective where they'd be comfortable to write like that? Do you think that there's going to be more media in that respect?
I'd say we're going to see a point. What I want to see is I don't want people chasing trends, but I want people to be able to write what they're comfortable or
yeah.
write what they want to without fearing backlash. So, like, if you have a story and it's a really cool story, but it's about a trans character and you feel like that's going to limit you, you shouldn't feel limited there. You should absolutely feel free to write that. And I want to see an environment where that's possible.
Yeah.
And, like, well, I think we're there. Like, I'm not really sure what else is happening in the, like, furry publication world, but, like, you know, we've certainly never had a problem with, you know, LGBT representation in this fandom.
Yeah. Yeah, like, that's true.
You know, like, gay is pretty much the default around here.
Yeah, it feels like it.
The weird thing is that it kind of isn't. Like, if you look at the It acceptance of it is definitely very high up, but percentage wise, if you look at the world statistics, it's still relatively, like, it's very, you know, what's the word, queer accepting.
Yeah.
But there are large amounts, swathes even of just, you know, hetero people out there. And weirdly enough,
I was talking with more of the perception, like, you know, even in terms of just, like, I guess it's because I came into the fandom in the early 2000s, and that was, like, you know, breasts were hard to come by in those days.
Yeah, I got you.
Are you sure about that? I was fine at the time. Wow. Okay. No, but I mean, like, that's actually true. But it's... Yeah, I mean, I think
part of that is that, like, you know, our biggest novel, like, producer of novels, our most prolific and successful producer of novels is very much in that camp. And so, like, yeah, it's just, you know, I don't think that's going to be a huge problem going forward. Like, I think if you want to have trans or, like, asexual characters, then they should absolutely go for it. And, like,
yeah,
you know, make porn in whatever combination of genitals you feel like making.
It's a very freeing process, I hear. Haha. Okay. I think we've run out of time.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's about 9:33 now. Unless you, obviously this is the point where you can like plug the absolute crap out of everything that you want to.
Oh, absolutely. Windfall 2 available from next week onward from.
Why was I thinking like available at your local hardware store? Why was I thinking that?
Look, if we could get it into hardware stores, we would sell it on hardware stores. I guarantee you. Also, that's available from Fur Planet. Also, keep an eye out for the next couple iterations of the Dragon's Horde anthologies, mm-hmm. which are available from Rabbit Valley. Sadly, not available at MFF. They're hoping for further confusion in February.
Okay. No, we'll look out for that.
Missed the window, unfortunately. But yeah, I'm in both of those. Mm-hmm. And yeah, if you are at MFF, if anybody listening here, Tempo and I will both be available. We'll be signing copies of the book.
Yay. Nice.
Yes.
Well, while you're at MFF, grab us a few nice little trinkets. We will reimburse you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like we'll make sure it's in Tempo's next care package.
Yay! I love it when Tempo sends us those care packages. There's always some interesting things in there, like the one button from The Life Aquatic. Like I did not expect that, and I had a proper laugh when I found it.
I know he has a great time finding stuff to send you guys.
Nice. Awesome. I'm so glad to hear that.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks for coming. We really do appreciate it. It's always a pleasure. Like you and Tempo are like favored at this point.
Aw, thanks.
But yeah, so for those of you listening, playing with music until midnight tonight. I might consider like shortening the stream just a little bit when it comes to the music part.
Just don't die.
I am
just take some time.
Tired. Yeah, I'm not then, dead yet.
And if
I'm
you guys
okay.
have like one of those weird brownout things that you might have. Uh-huh.
What?
You guys are talking about like some kind of power concerns?
Oh yeah, no, there's that as well. South Africa is currently in the position where it was in 2011 where our power gets turned off by government. Like every now and again to save electricity.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's like a 2-hour thing. Like they turn off the lights and everybody's like, yay, the lights are out. And then you've got 2 hours of playing like Scrabble or something like that.
Wow. All right.
Or anything in my enormous board game collection, which really comes in handy. Like,
all right. So move to South Africa and open a board game shop. Gotcha.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. Just teach people how to play Catan or just like, yeah. Start small, Catan, Ticket to Ride, and then eventually you'll sell them D&D kits.
Yeah, that's how... Oh man, you could have some killer D&D sessions if nobody had any power for 2 hours at a time.
Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah. Put your phones away!
Yeah, properly play Dead of Winter in like atmospheric conditions.
Exactly. Like you get like candles and lanterns.
Yes. Totes. Like immediately makes me happy. Mm-hmm. Although waxing in my board games immediately turns me off. I don't want candles or flames in my board games.
Mm-hmm. All right, guys. I will talk to you soon.
Yes. Yeah. Awesome. Cheers, thank you for being on again.
Thanks for having me on. Talk to you later.
Yeah. Cool.
Talk to you later.
Cheers, everybody. See you next week. Maybe.
Cheers, guys. Yeah.
Bye.
Next. Bye-bye.